Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host. Welcome to our very first episode of 2025. It's already been a hell of a year, but I am confident our little space on this here's stoop will be a balm in these very turbulent, uncertain times. On this episode, I'm in conversation with two amazing activists who have helped transform housing policy in Oregon, Sam Diaz and Mary Kyle McCurdy. Sam and Mary Kyle both work with 1000 Friends of Oregon, an organization that, for over 50 years, has worked with Oregonians to leverage the state's special and unique land use planning program to foster connected, vibrant, and beautiful cities and towns while protecting their farms, forests, and iconic scenic areas from sprawl development and irreversible conversion. Sam is the executive director at 1000 Friends, where he brings experience during his time in local and state government, as well as a conservation philanthropy focused on solutions for the American West. He served in policy advisor roles for a Portland mayor who shepherded landmark housing reforms, and for a California governor who tied the state's cap and trade programs investments to affordable housing as part of a walkable, rollable, and vibrant communities in small towns and large cities across the state. Sam serves on multiple national and regional networks, including the WNN, Welcoming Neighbors Network, Executive Director Cohort. He has been a speaker for TEDx Portland, the largest TEDx in North America. Sam is also on the board of a statewide nonprofit organization called the Housing Development Center. Sam is deeply committed to his roots, proud of his family's journey to the United States through the Bracero program to work on the dams and in the fields and orchards in rural Northern California, and family, fairness, and the belief of an unconditional right to opportunity for everyone remain a constant source of inspiration for his work. Mary Kyle has been affiliated with 1000 Friends for some 35 years, where she is now their associate director and managing attorney, serving as senior staff attorney, legislative lead, and as the person who oversees all of their program work. She has a long and distinguished career as an attorney specializing in Oregon's land use planning program. Born and raised near Chicago, she earned her BA in human biology at Stanford and her law degree at the University of California at Davis. She then clerked for a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Portland, and it was in between her undergraduate and graduate work that she discovered 1000 Friends of Oregon. In Oregon, Mary Kyle's favorite places are the North Coast and the Wallawas. I hope I said that right. I looked it up. When she's away from work, she spends time with her husband and daughters and continues to explore the Pacific Northwest. She's an avid cross-country skier, cyclist, hiker, and reader. There's obviously a lot to cover with these two. They're incredibly interesting people with incredibly varied backgrounds, and I don't want to keep you from the conversation any longer. So we'll jump in, and before I do, let me just apologize if I sound a little stuffy on this intro. I got hit by a bout of seasonal allergies right after we recorded the episode. So the episode audio is good, but the intro might have sounded a little funny. But anyways, without further ado, let's jump in. Well, hey, Mary Kyle. Hey, Sam. How's it going?
Good.
Hey there. Good to be with you.
Yeah, welcome to The Stoop. You're our first episode of 2025, which is super exciting. I also don't know as much about what y'all have done in Oregon as I did with like the Austin folks and some of that since I'm based here in Austin. So I'm super excited to learn what you did and apply it here as well. Y'all are in the middle of a legislative session right now, aren't you?
We're at the start of a legislative session.
The start. Okay. Okay. So it's ramping up.
Yes.
Yeah. Similarly here, we just started in January, here in Texas, and it's already getting busy. So I really appreciate your time. Before we dig into what y'all have done in Oregon in years past, and I'd love to talk about what you're hoping this year toward the end of this. But before we do that, I would love if we could just go and maybe start with Mary Kyle and tell your housing story. Like, how did you get involved in housing and what motivates you to keep going?
I was hired, by 1000 Friends of Oregon in 1990 as the urban lands attorney. And over that time, I've, explored through both, litigation, research, advocacy, what that means. And here in Oregon, our land use planning program has, among other things, urban growth boundaries. Those require every city of any size to delineate a boundary that is intended to include approximately 20 years worth of land for all urban uses, housing, commercial, parks, institutional uses, employment, etc. And that's to both protect farm and forest land and natural areas, and also to focus on great communities. And there it became clear, especially as Oregon's population started to increase, that there was a lot more we could be doing inside our urban growth boundaries to make sure those places are livable and meet the housing and transportation needs of all Oregonians. Our land use planning program calls for every city to use all the land use tools, meaning primarily zoning and planning, to set the table to make possible housing for all Oregonians in every city and town. So that means diverse housing types in all locations, affordable to those of across the economic spectrum. We have not done a great job of doing that, but we do have that as a core value. So I have been very interested in pursuing how we can fulfill that promise of that part of our land use planning program. So we'll get into it more, some of the things that we've done in Oregon, but that is really what led into it, and going into those solutions that we've been advocating for and been very successful on has also really illuminated for us and for all Oregonians, and I think it's across the country now, how much of the fact that we have nationally not been providing the an adequate amount of housing or the diversity or affordability of housing that folks need is really rooted in our racially and economically discriminatory housing practices of that started 100 years or so or more ago, really. And not just, so we see that on the ground today. Our housing patterns, where almost all of it is detached single family housing, the most expensive, the most land extensive. That is what we really realize we need to break through, those historic discriminatory redlining housing practices, if we were really to provide housing for all in every neighborhood.
Yeah, that's a history we've talked about a little bit on this podcast even before. A lot of folks outside of the housing movement don't know about zoning. I didn't before I studied urban geography in college. I'd grown up kind of in more or less suburbia, and not I felt what was wrong with it as I lived there, but I didn't have the words or the analysis to like put words to that. But as I've gotten into this work, and I think evident by what y'all have done and the way you talk about the issue, that's like the center of it, right? Like,
Well, I think we have all have a lot to thank Richard Rothstein, who wrote The Color of Law, for bringing that, because he came at it from an educator's viewpoint. Why are schools segregated? And as I was growing up, I was sort of realizing, it's because all of the people who live in this neighborhood are all the same, right? Or, this is, and but it wasn't just land use and zoning. It started out as overt discrimination in lending, mortgage practices and all of that. The federal, by law, people were black people who were considered, undesirable immigrants, etc., were zoned out of certain areas, or were kept out of certain areas, and overtly and legally. And then when the Supreme Court said you cannot overtly discriminate, then people look to more subtle land use zoning tools, and detached single family housing zones has been that tool of choice and very effective, unfortunately.
yeah, it's here in Austin, you can see a pretty stark difference between those places that were white enclaves designed as such, and they're very low density, very single family, that kind of thing. Well, we can dig into more of that, but Sam, I want to hear your housing story too. I'm so curious.
I think what you both were saying really resonated with me. I think my story starts with my family immigrating from Mexico through the Bracero program, and my grandparents worked on Orville Dam, Shasta Dam in Northern California. And then once the dams were built, they then worked in the orchards and the fields. And my dad is one of nine, and I have to start there because I'm just so proud of the journey. I'm so proud of, my family's contributions and the overall community, like farm worker community, labor union, and just the values of hard work and family and opportunity. And so that's really where my story begins, even before I'm alive, because that's what they instilled in me in the dinner table, and doing homework. And so I think the what you and Mary Kyle were talking about is something that my family, my community members growing up felt. And we complained about it, of like water alerts, or I'm an inhaler kid. And many of my family members and my friends were inhaler kids. And I just thought that that was normal. And I didn't realize it wasn't normal until I was able to go to school in New York, at a small college called Colgate University, and began learning some of the terms and some of the tools that government and the private sector have used to effectively decide who gets what opportunity, who can live where, and what that quality of life looks like or feels like for people, depending on your income, depending on your background, depending on the color of your skin. And so, of course, that really helped me understand that it's no, through no fault of community members, that we have to, get a new inhaler every month, but it really is preventable and it really is designed. And so that I think is in some ways empowering for community members to know it was for me. And that's what motivated me. And that's what continues to motivate me to work in natural resource management and land use planning, and ultimately try to figure out what are some of the bans on these tools that we really need as community members? What are some of the investments that we need that other neighborhoods have received that we were left out. So that's really where I come at it in this conversation, and that's one of the main reasons why I love working at 1000 Friends of Oregon, and just excited to be able to connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network, because I think we see it's not just a pattern that happened in Northern California or happens here in Oregon, but it really is a disease that we are all suffering from across the nation.
Yeah, I think so often in places that have dealt with the housing crisis later, like here in Austin. I mean, Austin out of Texas got it sooner than a lot of places, but certainly our reckoning came after y'all on the West Coast, right? And so much of what we take for granted as just a given here, this kind of single family sprawl stuff, people don't necessarily think of it as by a specific design or as a way of excluding, like deciding who's going to live where, like you said, Sam. And it's like this kind of, to Mary Kyle, to your point, like this idea that they find sneakier ways to do the work of segregation, where like, well, but anybody who makes middle income can live in that suburban neighborhood over there. Okay, but who is allowed to make that level of income? Who has had the historical familial trajectory that led to that level of income? And those legacies don't change just in single lifetimes, right? And that's luckily here in Austin, we have billed ourselves as more progressive than Texas, and we've constantly failed to live up to that ideal, but we're trying. And doing that work of education and helping people see the built form for what it is has been huge. And so much of that work, I have to say, is a credit to the work that y'all pioneered over there on the West Coast, through 1000 Friends and Sightline and so many of those that have instructed the work that's happened elsewhere to help us realize the issues and solve them. So let's jump into that. What did y'all do in Oregon? This was what, 2019? And how did you do it?
I think even rewind back, and Mary Kyle, if you can tell the origin story,
The first 20. Well, first it helps to When I say this, I don't want it to mean it can't be done in other states that don't have what I'm about to say. But having a statewide land use planning program with a state component and local implementation for decades really helps. Every city has to comply with these housing things. It can be scaled differently for different sizes, but it's an even playing field. Every city is supposed to be providing the land use tools to provide housing for all. And we have a culture here of oftentimes resented, but the state does have an ability to set this is the structure. You got to comply, you know. It's so, but in any event, there was an attempt in 2017. There was a so, and also another thing that really helped was that the Speaker of the House, who is now our governor, is very pro housing for all. And these were her bills. So in 2017, she had a bill that did a variety of housing things, including requiring all single family lots in cities over 2,500 in size to allow ADUs, accessory dwelling units, as we call them here. And it also required that cities over some other size, I can't remember, had to allow duplexes on all single family lots. Well, you'd think that, you know, duplexes were, you know, that we were asking people to accept a plutonium plant on their lot or something. It really, it kind of, it, that ultimately got taken out of the bill. But I recall the day that I testified in favor of that bill, and then the Speaker of the House testified right after me in favor of the bill. And she went a step further in her testimony than I did, because she's the Speaker of the House, she can do this. She actually called out the racism in the zoning, right? Very overtly. I said, we're seeing the historic redlining and stuff like that. She carried it to like, we can't, you know, continuing it is racism today. And she got a lot of pushback from legislators.
I'm sure.
So the duplex part of it went out, the ADU part sailed through. So we got ADUs, you know, that was first step. 2 years later, again, I'm going to thank Richard Rothstein, because in that 2 years, he spoke around the country. You could not open up the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, something without articles about the inherent racism and exclusionary impact, economically exclusionary impact of detached single family zoning, of exclusively that, and large lot zoning and those sorts of things. It really changed the conversation here in Oregon, and I think in a lot of other places. So that when 2019 came, we got an even better bill, our middle housing bill. And we know that it is not going to change things overnight. We talk about a housing crisis, but that is kind of a misnomer. It took decades to get here, and we're not going to, it's going to take a while to get out of it. But middle housing is a huge step in breaking up that the redlined patterns that we see. So I don't know if I answered all your question, but that's really, and Sam, is that what you meant? That was the part of the story you wanted me to tell? Oh, and then we also had a great coalition. Let me just tell you that. Passing that bill in 2019, it passed on the last day on a Sunday afternoon of the session, during a session when there was repeated walkouts, that day from the Senate. And it got through on a Sunday afternoon.
That
And
was from were the walkouts for that bill or for a
no, they were
different?
from a different reason, but you know, who knows what was going to get scooped up in that. So, but we had bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition, and it took a coalition of organizations, us, the Oregon Home Builders Association, the Housing Alliance, Allison McIntosh, if you haven't met your colleague yet, she was with the Housing Alliance then, and someone from the Oregon Law Center, and basically Legal Aid, and we brought in lots of other organizations. So we our final, you know, set of logos was 27 or 28 organizations that you do not always see all of them on the same piece of paper. So ranging from, you know, a tenants' rights group to the home builders and the realtors, and transit advocates, land use advocates, environmental advocates, affordable housing developers, all in between, all supporting this.
I think also just to understand the like what the crunch was, you know, when we think about 2014 to 2015, so like 10 years ago, Portland was very much a town to move to. People were coming in. There were neighborhoods that were quickly, you know, it was the visual displacement and the gentrification was just something that if you lived in the Portland area, you were seeing, you were feeling. So there were just a lot of growing pains, a lot of changes. And, you know, that had income, that had implications for longtime residents, that had implications for, you know, renters who were being moved around. It was a wicked game of musical chairs. And so there was just a lot of frustration and anger about, you know, the state and the city and, you know, the state's largest city not having a strong handle on the housing market. And so as a result, there was a lot of anti-developer sentiment. There was a lot of suspicion about the housing market. There was some major calls for reform for tenant rights and for displacement, anti-displacement programming. And so there was that was kind of a big groundswell, and A Thousand Friends was one of the early organizations to really corral that energy and channel it through a Portland for Everyone program, which was the campaign, kind of the local version of what Mary Kyle's statewide version and story that she just shared, and also an anti-displacement PDX coalition to really look at, you know, we really need to make sure and honor, you know, longtime residents here who contribute to the culture, to the well-being, to the vibrancy of the city, and make sure that this can be a place for everyone here and now. So it, that Portland for Everyone program, which started in 2015 to 2016, amazing staffer Madeline Kovacs, she, like Mary Kyle, her more steering committee members than I can name, really galvanized this broad and diverse coalition to focus on basically like what you could argue it would be a pilot of removing this ban on duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes in the city. And it's always nice. It's always nice to have a pilot because you get to test, you get to have like a place-based organizing strategy. People have their point of references that are much easier to understand at the local level. And you also are kind of inadvertently, you're getting elected officials to compete with each other. So then, you know, the mayor and the city council at Portland all of a sudden is, are they going to finish it first or is the state going to finish it first? And so that I think was this, to my opinion, an unintended benefit from having these kind of local organizing efforts. And then by the time Portland for Everyone Coalition really, you know, I think, you know, was drawing so much public support and positive headlines, other cities started reaching out and said, hey, how do we lean into this anger and frustration at the local level and channel it into something that is solution oriented, that does have a lot of consensus building opportunity amongst the development community and the environmental activists and our renter rights groups and our racial justice advocates to really make a game, you know, a play here for something much, much better than we're currently experiencing.
I am so intrigued by this because so much of what you're saying about the pains that were felt in Portland are like one to one, and the response to them publicly are like one to one with what we felt in Austin, especially with East Austin, where, you know, the city historically had moved all the people of color, not technically by force, but effectively by force, to what is east of now I-35, right? And then as the city grew rapidly in this century, that was the land that was allowed to develop. And so you saw rapid gentrification, displacement, et cetera, that still continues, though, we're doing work to rectify that. And you got similar concerns about tenants' rights, about gentrification, displacement, skepticism of development. How did you weave that together in Portland? And I want to talk about that at the local level, and in the context of your state, which has a Democratic majority, and then maybe reflect on how it differs from those of us who are in red states but blue cities, because there's something else there. But like when you were weaving together that we need to build more homes, people are skeptical of development, what was the thing that kept people in the room?
So I would say that having an anti-displacement PDX coalition and a local tenant organizing group, Portland Tenants United, and Portland for Everyone, which is really, focused. We were inviting people to talk about zoning, to talk about what the investments in infrastructure were, and we were presenting to neighborhood associations, to business districts, to the teachers union. So just really making sure to get the word out and ultimately making a pitch for saying, hey, here's a benefit, here's a tangible benefit for the anticipated outcome if this proposal goes forward. So just a lot of grassroots outreach happening, day in, day out from the Portland for Everyone program, thanks to the steering committee. And I think over 60, I think the height of it was over 60 formal coalition members signing on and helping. Like it wasn't a passive sign-on, it was an affirmative. You will help with action alerts, you will help with presentations, you will bring in, other folks and other partner organizations who you work with. And really this being a really exciting opportunity for us to work all together. But there were mega meetings between the Portland Tenant United and the Anti-Displacement PDX Coalition and the Portland for Everyone program. And so those, in your tried and true fashion, like the red, yellow, green cards in terms of what parts of the proposal were we really excited about, and then what were the deal breakers? And getting a sense from, that mega coalition meeting, those meetings of, what are some things that we need to spend a little bit more time on in the proposal in order to get everyone to yellow? And ultimately, we wanted people to green. So people were really excited about it. And I think at the local level, we had a lot of creativity and flexibility because it was Portland and we didn't have to play really, like, compared to what Mary Kyle does, like really, really tough partisan politics, because it's the local level. This is supposed to be nonpartisan. This is nuts and bolts policy making. It should be at its finest. And so the local level is really a great laboratory to just say, hey, can we just be real? And what is happening on that block of the neighborhood, or what is happening in this part of the city? And just talk about it that way. This isn't a Republican or a Democrat issue. This is just a Portland issue. And so that enabled us to have just real conversations about the nuts and bolts of the proposal instead of hyperbolic arguments or posturing that sometimes can get, ultimately get you real knocked around and feeling like you're in a pinball machine. So the way that we went forward was the final proposal before council, which got everyone excited, council chambers packed full of people excited, ultimately the votes to secure the proposal. Was really this concept around a density bonus for guaranteed affordable housing as part of a sixplex. And so if the proposal itself, for those who may not know, it's called Residential Infill Project. It applies to the majority of residential land in the city. There were a number of overlays that were taken out of it. So for example, if a slope or environmentally sensitive area, some of those areas kind of kicked out of this project. And then there was like a hazards area. So if there was an area susceptible to a mudslide or to flooding, then that was also kicked out. And so, but it still encompassed about 70% of the land in the city that was, as Mary Kyle mentioned, exclusively for single detached houses. And you couldn't build a duplex if you wanted to. And so, the density bonus concept came up to say, well, in this land that this project would rezone, would enable people to have more housing options, housing types that they could build. What if we gave a leg up to our affordable housing partners who are in this coalition and who are delivering solutions? The Habitat for Humanities of Portland. And we have a number of them, Hacienda CDC, Proud Ground, in partnership with Habitat for Humanity, just amazing, middle housing, affordable housing developers. And so we said, okay, well, does everyone agree that we should give them a leg up in this process in order to build, to enable them have a red carpet experience? And everyone, there was a green card. And so that was where we were able to concept an amendment to the original proposal to say, okay, if you're a Habitat for Humanity and you're building this, affordable housing, you should be able to build six homes by right on something where only private development would be able to build four houses by right. So that was a really big piece of the proposal in order to really authentically say and show our values that affordability was going to be part of this project. It wasn't this performative gesture to say, oh, we care, and maybe one day, because we've added a couple of homes, it will be affordable. No, we're going to give a leg up right now to our affordable housing partners who are delivering housing right now. So that really made a really big difference. The other thing is AARP Oregon was a huge partner in this. And their main thing, their red card, so to speak, for us to listen into, was making sure that some of the homes in these triplexes, fourplexes were made for people of older age, who wanted to age in place. And when you think about, growing old, when you think about, people with disabilities, like if you have a three-story condo and your primary bedroom is on the top floor and your bathroom's on the bottom floor, and the configuration of that home isn't going to be a great experience for someone who's trying to age in place or someone who has physical disabilities. So that's really where we did require, if you built more than three homes on a space, that it would need to be at least one unit in the development would need to comply with ADA requirements. And so that you had wider door frames, you had the primary bedroom on the floor. And so those details really mattered for people. And we were able to communicate that back when we got those kinds of questions from people in neighborhood associations or in public testimony settings. And so I think that the amount of thought that went into the mega coalition meetings and just learning what people's needs are, and then translating that into the proposal, ultimately built trust and got us the votes. And then more, I think in my mind, more importantly, it has stood the test of time. 5 years later, we have an entire new city council. I think this is the second new version of city council since the proposal passed in 2020, where this is a celebration. This is the new status quo. And so I think it's beautiful to see this be a durable policy win and not a chip that politicians are playing with. And I think that is because we were able to really facilitate those nuts and bolts conversations.
I'll just add to that that the conversation at the state level, as I said earlier, we had bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. This did not split along party lines. And in fact, the opposition often came from legislators who represented liberal, Democratic districts who did not want to see change in their neighborhoods. And those were some of the hardest votes to get. And we did not get all of them, and including Portland legislators and some around the state. I think from those Republicans who voted against it, it was more of a we don't want the state telling cities what to do kind of a perspective. But from the Democrats who voted against it, it was they represented districts who did not want to see change. Change is hard for everyone, right? We need to acknowledge that and then tell the stories of who needs this housing. And that's where allies like AARP and others come in and talk about it. There is nothing, you know, this is who needs it. This is why people who are living in those bigger houses, they want to move out. They want to stay in their neighborhood. They want that young family that they once were to be able to move into their house, but they want to stay where they're familiar with the pharmacy and the grocery store and that sort of thing. So, to tell those stories really helps, but it was not a partisan, it was not a cleanly partisan issue. And both I was involved with that residential infill project that Sam described and at the state level. And all interests got something out of it. I think that, you know, it was down into the weeds of it at the city level, because that's where you do the zoning code, right? But, you know, even at the state level, from the home builder's perspective, they see the opportunity to build more homes. You know, yes, it's inside urban growth boundaries. You know, we might have some disagreements on that, but it is building more homes. And from others, they see more homes that potentially are attainable to me. The middle housing legislation at the state did not require affordability, but you could show that if you can get four lots, and this is where Habitat and for Humanity came in, they actually gave great testimony saying, we are never going to buy a lot where we can only put one house. That is just is not penciled out for us. But if we can put four homes, now we're talking, we can serve our clients. And that just made those kinds of things made a huge difference. And it, you know, and you heard the city too. Everyone got what they wanted. And then Sam, I think one thing you didn't mention that we did at the city or that the city did, I don't think you mentioned it, was there was concern about displacement. And so the city did a couple of studies showing the potential displacing impact of the residential infill project. And to simplify it, basically showed we're having displacement now, right, without this additional housing. And as long as we don't build more housing that people need, we're going to have this musical chairs impact, right? Of, yeah. And but with the elements that were in the residential infill project, including limits on the size of new houses that one could build, but you got more square footage and such if you built more units, affordable or accessible. Anyway, when you took that, then the study showed there are a few of these neighborhoods here. I think there were maybe two or three where displacement could definitely occur. So let's build in some anti-displacement measures and community-based agreements and stuff. That is kind of a new area, right? You know, Sam's closer to this than I am. I think anti-displacement measures is still, we're still learning, right? Various tools and things to do that. But it really helped that conversation because displacement was happening anyway.
Yeah. And the form of that, you know, is the city did partner with they're now called Imagine Black, but it was the Portland African American Leadership Forum. And this was a core partner in the Anti-Displacement PDX Coalition. And so the city granted it was at least $100,000 per year to Portland African American Leadership Forum to help with those anti-displacement measures. And like what that means for some, like, you know, that's such a high-level term. But basically, if the city went forward, and as the city did, in rezoning and allowing more development potential on that land, well, the land prices are more likely to go up. And you may have local developers starting to try to buy up housing, a house that is currently pretty, you know, affordable, and flip it and or basically demolish it or reconstruct it into a fourplex. So that way the developer makes money. And then ultimately, like, it's great for big picture, right? Oh, wow, we just got three more homes. This home that may have been, you know, older got refurbished or it got demoed, and then now we have four new ones. But if you're the family living in that home, that is, you know, that's a threat that's a veiled threat, right? And so that's really where PALF would come in to help that those in those three neighborhoods at risk of saying, okay, we need to do some homeowner education. We need to work with these communities. So it was great to have that information because ultimately it helped the city allocate resources in a strategic way. And so you're able to have the win-win scenario happen more likely than not.
Yeah, I am super curious about Mary Kyle, to go back to some of the state work. Like you mentioned, it crosses partisan lines. And similarly here in Texas, some of our bills that would have been helpful in the last session died because, Austin Democrats at the last minute said no. And here it was largely because the state is preempting cities on everything, right? They had a so-called Death Star bill. And so that makes it hard to vote for anything that seems like preemption. Very understandable. When we're communicating here in a red context, I think sometimes there's a fear that if we talk too much about tenants' rights or displacement or gentrification, that we might scare off would-be Republican supporters. And obviously as a communications person, I know you with respect to your constituency, you want to speak their language. Like if you're talking about more flexibility to use a piece of land for more homes, it could be property rights for someone who cares about property rights. It could be that flexibility for someone who cares about those options and the freedom to choose. Do you think there is merit to that concern about like scaring off would-be votes? Because it seems like the partisan lines always split similarly when we do this, whether it's somewhere like Oregon or somewhere like Texas.
Probably, those I would pitch the message in a way that resonates most with whoever's vote you need, because they're all accurate, right? It's actually, all true. And we did not say you should be able to use whatever you can. You should be able to do whatever you can with your land. That was not part of any of the messaging, but that you should allow more diverse housing types. We have decided that this is our residential land, or the communities come together and zone this land for residential use, but we're not actually letting everybody have the opportunity to have a home there. And really, in Oregon, I would say that conversation took off when middle class and upper middle class people were finding that their children couldn't get homes. So our dynamic here was, and maybe this is true in Austin, at least, I don't know about the rest of Texas, where when the Great Recession came in 2008, 2009, 2010, the population continued increasing here. But across the country, the home building industry tanked for a while. But we still had people coming, and we are still catching up with that hole into which we found ourselves of building back to meet that need, because people moved out of their parents' home, right? And all that. And as well as for those who continue to come. So it was really hitting a much wider spectrum. The need for housing and diverse housing types was hitting a wider spectrum of Oregonians economically and racially and all that. And that was a way to talk about it to a lot of people. But I would suspect that not every argument is going to resonate with every audience.
I would just I you know I think I want to share a story in my time staffing the mayor during the COVID-19 pandemic. And mayor was part of the Mayor's Alliance, and we were preparing for a meeting with Chair Price and Congress and Chair of the Infrastructure Committee. And all of the mayors were assembling on this Zoom, and the mayor knew many of them, and I was like, why is this on our agenda? Like, of all the things, of all the things we have to do, we're doing COVID pop-ups with community members right now. We're trying to figure out the drive-through situation. And I was just like, why is this an agenda? Like, why is this a thing? And then we get on the Zoom, And Chair Price, before any of the mayors say anything, says, "I have been waiting for this for you to come visit with me." He goes, "Local elected officials represent the nonpartisan needs of everyday Americans. And you all are supposed to be banging down my door on critical infrastructure needs every single session." And it just was like this epiphany for me that I think there is amazing, beautiful power in local elected service. And that is where you are. Part of your job is communicating to higher levels of government what the needs are on the ground in order to make sure that the sewer's working, the water's working, your housing, you have what you need for to create the housing that your constituents need. And so I would say that there is a lot of power in not just grassroots of community members, but grassroots of like the League of Cities or the National League of Cities or the Mayor's Alliances. Because I do think that will cut across partisan division. And I think infrastructure, as we've seen, over different federal administrations, that is something that should be raised constantly, and something that I believe Congress and whoever's in office and in the executive branch should be able to easily comprehend and move on. So, and that is it gives tangible returns back to constituents too. You're able to point to something. There's a ribbon cutting. You're gonna have a shovel in your hand and you're gonna be turning over dirt. And so those are sort of the photo op moments that actually make it feel like there is, government is working, that our elected officials are listening and actually doing something in to make the quality of life better for tomorrow. So I do have to say there we did have many local elected officials help, not just in creating this legislation, but once this legislation passed, we needed local leadership and we needed to support local leadership to implement this legislation. These cities and towns then had to go and adopt local ordinances to remove the ban on duplexes and triplexes and figure out what that ordinance would look like and what the fees would look like for developers so it actually would work. And there were two lawsuits that I can remember. Mary Kyle will correct me and keep me honest on that, but there were two lawsuits that came shortly after the legislation, and there was the city of Eugene, where University of Oregon is, and Hood River, which is actually the most expensive place in Oregon. It's located in the Columbia Gorge, iconic spot, and they voluntarily adopted missing middle housing code reform, and a group of homeowners sued those cities for adopting the missing middle housing, saying it's going to destroy the character of our neighborhood, of our community. And we evaluated what the city did. They did the right thing. And we actually dedicated some staff attorney time to intervening in support of what the cities had done. And, again, those local leaders called over, the mayor of Eugene, got to give a shout out to Lucy Vinnis, who's just incredible. And she goes like, just thank you so much. We're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to help solve, our housing affordability crisis here in Eugene. And it means a lot when we have communities supporting us and partnering with us on these changes.
I'll say though that the city of Eugene is one of the places back when 2017 with that ADU bill, they did not want to do that. That was a problem. They are one of the cities where of all of their legislators, and they're all Democratic, only one vote is I think only one voted in favor of the middle housing bill. Maybe someone else came along with it. They were a hard nut to crack because they have many progressive people who consider themselves progressive, and this was not going to be it. So I just want to say, but they came around. They elected a different mayor, and the current mayor is someone who has been a leader of a pro housing organization there. So it's possible. Change is possible. Same with Albany.
Yeah, I love that. I think similarly here, it took a total transformation of city council, and then you get incredible results. I mean, we have like year over year it's something near 10% rent decline, which is like, oh my God, I never thought I'd see that here in Austin. But I was going to ask about this. So Sam, I'm glad you brought us here. You're, I guess, 5 years out from the legislative win that we spent a lot of time talking at the state. You're 2 to 3 years out, I guess, from like full-ish implementation of that, if I understand correctly. What are there any big lessons that you've learned or reflections on that that you're carrying into your work now or that anyone in the network should know?
Yeah, well, I think, okay, so just this week, this is early February, the City of Portland issued a progress report on the residential infill project and basically showed there has been pent-up demand for this kind of housing type. And so it's actually taken up about 40% of all permits in the city in the last year have been about for duplexes, for triplexes, fourplexes. I'm definitely seeing developments happen throughout my neighborhood here in University Park in North Portland. The exciting thing is, even for private development, we're seeing the average sales price for these new market rate middle housing units to be about $250,000 to $300,000 less than that of its, new market rate single detached home. So I think that has been such a relief, such a win to see the results of that kind of policy change. And then we also know that the city is able to take care of outdated infrastructure because this new development has is it pays into a citywide infrastructure fund, and it helps offset some of the nearby infrastructure requirements. If you need a new road, if you need different sewer or water hookup, because there are more people in there. So that is just amazing to see that, over 1,400 homes in just the span of last year have come to fruition, and people are moving in. People are able to call Portland home, and they're able to really enjoy and have a great experience and quality of life here in Portland. And then the House Bill 2001, the 2009 legislation included a deadline. And so at this point, now over 55 cities and towns in Oregon have all adopted some version of their housing options zoning reform. So that way you can build a duplex in it. I think one of the interesting lessons we're seeing, and I'll let Mary Kyle say more about this, is that our governor is her main piece of legislation in terms of policy change when it comes to housing is actually doubling down on this kind of approach and opening up more options for missing middle housing. So it's exciting to see that, I think the results are in. It looks to be really, really positive. And also our leaders here in Oregon are doubling down on that as well.
Did you want me to add anything to that, Cutter? But I know we're coming to the end of our time, so I'm just wanting to make sure I'm going to
Yeah.
what are we doing this session?
Yeah, I would love to hear what you're doing this session if you're willing to share.
Yeah. So, as Sam mentioned, when we pass that middle housing that allows duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, cottage clusters, and townhomes on most single family lots, cities had a very short window, about a year and a half to 2 years to comply. And if they didn't adopt a complying ordinance, there was one already created by our state land use agency that would pop in. It's a really great structure. I recommend it in other places. This is the minimum standards you have to meet, but if you don't, and we're going to evaluate it, then this other one pops in automatically. And they all almost all complied on time. And now we're just realizing as it's rolling out, there's still some like tweaks and artificial unnecessary barriers at the local level. It's just some things we didn't see. Other ones like, we didn't know that about that one. So, that our so sh sh the governor has a bill that is aimed at, as Sam said, doubling down on middle housing and infill housing to make it easier to for these to be located. So adding some more flexibility to what some of those are, like cottage clusters and such, and streamlining some local processes, that sort of thing. So we're definitely behind that. Accompanying this and is another bill that she is bringing this session that the legislature, I think, really started realizing the magnitude of this issue in the last legislative session, and they will be back to do it again this session, which is we need infrastructure. We need pipes and roads paid for in order to build housing. We can zone the land and do all that other stuff, but the state and federal governments have not been paying for the kind of the major infrastructure projects the way they did 50, 100 years ago. And even so, in cities, there's a lot of land, tens of thousands of acres of land, you know, zoned for housing, for residential use across the state, but they need much of it needs an extension of a road or a pipe, some upgrade of something in order to actually allow that housing to be built. And the financial capacity of cities is limited, so for a variety of reasons. So she has the governor has another bill this session to continue to fund. There was one last session and or a couple of bills last session on the subject from legislators and the governor, and they'll continue this session with more funding for infrastructure. And I think we're really also all trying to find creative ways to provide that infrastructure for whether it's affordable housing or market rate housing, especially since we're probably not going to be able to rely on the federal government m much, if at all, for a bit. So really trying to figure out some, you know, new tools for that. So there's another bill on infrastructure. We're also supporting a bill that is would make more innovative housing methods and materials, both creating an industry for that here, but also citing allowing them to be cited as a right. So by innovative methods and materials, you're probably seeing some of this in Austin. The housing that's built off-site and largely off-site and assembled on-site. And there's different methods to that. It's not just what people think of as a manufactured home. There's that, and there's other ways too. So really trying to grow that industry here and allow those as of right on any residential lot.
Is that the same thing as prefab or prefabrication homes?
There's prefab. It can be using some of it comes just in boxes like IKEA boxes. Others, you know, there's also 3D printed houses that actually are being built in Oregon. And then there's another name for some. There's also mass timber, cross-laminated timber, and there's another terminology for different kind of methods and materials to build it. But the idea is you can build that quicker off-site and assemble it on-site with less, with fewer workers too. And construction workers, the lack of construction workers is something we hear, particularly in the smaller communities in Oregon. So being able to deliver that kind of housing with reliance on fewer workers is also very useful. It brings the cost down.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's wonderful to see that, like, after the big wins, how the work transforms.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, y'all will continue to be a lesson to all of us who are following in your stead. And I am so grateful to learn from you both. We're coming up here on time, but I just want to open the floor. If there's anything else y'all want to share before we part, or if we're wrapped up, that's okay too.
I would just wrap up by saying this should be a bipartisan, nonpartisan issue. And I think looking for those opportunities is what we all need to be doing right now, to build those relationships, but to also get housing that people need on the ground.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, I think when the progress report came out, it just was a really great reminder and just excuse to reach back out to our, Portland for Everyone Coalition members, to business supporters, to, major foundations who supported us, to grassroots donors, and For whatever reason, in my brain, 2020 does not feel that long ago, but it already is 5 years ago. And I think recenter and reaffirm the values that the Portland for Everyone program, really was built on. And we weren't some political, we didn't work together because of politics. We work together to really improve this place that we call home and our community. And so I think that we outlast, I think it's important, our advocacy, our coalitions, they outlast any one elected official or any one administration. And that is the beauty and the power of movement building. And so that is, I think, what we need that more than ever right now. And I think that is kind of a beautiful formula and some wisdom from movement builders. And so when you put together your coalition in your own state, try to find that big tent and ultimately find a place that recharges and re-energizes you. Because the policy part is easy. Like we know what we need to do. Like we have policy playbooks. We have amazing think tanks like Sightline Institute, who are rolling them out. It's really this relationship building, this bridge building, this coalition building that ultimately takes time. And I think it's really hard to listen and to talk to each other right now. And so to be able to have something that does unify people, around real solutions for a housing affordability crisis is actually a really beautiful thing to lean into.
I agree. I think that's beautiful. And at a time when opportunity and hope can feel kind of low, that's really refreshing to hear and imagine. So I think we'll wrap there because that's fantastic. And I am, again, so grateful, Mary Kyle, Sam, for your time, for your generosity, for your work, and for your continued guidance of all that we're doing in this big, crazy, beautiful housing movement. So thank y'all.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
We want to spread it around the country because we need to keep it going, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, y'all. These two couple a wealth of experience and a generosity of spirit. It was such a privilege to talk to them today, and I hope you've learned as much from them as I did. You can find 1000 Friends of Oregon online at friends.org and on social media. They are at 1000 Oregon, and that's 1000, 1000oregon.bsky.social on Blue Sky, and at 1000 Oregon on Instagram, also with the numbers. You can also find Sam Diaz and Mary Kyle McCurdy themselves on LinkedIn. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram, and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for our show was composed by my friend Nolan Hopkins. If you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, just shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on any social media. My handle is at CutterWGonzalez across all platforms. Thanks for joining us. Talk to y'all real soon.